Welcome to The Author Speaks. I'm Helen Thomas of Women Writing Architecture, speaking today with Anna Hulch and Sol Perez Martinez, both architects and architectural historians, who have recently completed a five-year research project led by Anna at the Department of Architecture at ETH Zurich. The European Research Council-funded Women Writing Architecture, 1700 to 1900, Female Experiences of the Built, or WOWA for short, studied female experiences of architecture as recorded in documentary writing drawn from specific regions in South America and Europe during this period. Joining Anna and Sol and me in conversation is architect, poet and researcher Djabeli Sirineni, who has recently joined our editorial team. Based in Dessau, Djabeli is checking in via Zoom as we enjoy the exhibition Women Writing Architecture, 1700 to 1900, at the Department of Architecture. This was curated by Anna in collaboration with her doctoral student, Elena Rieger, and Sol, who carried out postdoctoral research during the project. The subject of our discussion today, the book Women Writing Architecture, 1700 to 1900, Expanding Histories, was edited by Anna and Sol. It brings together from across the world 29 different voices, both male and female. These are organised into an intriguing structure with different scales and intentions. Together and framed by a thought-provoking introduction that brings questions around how architecture is defined and by whom to the fore, these introduce a context for producing architecture that engages with the disparities of global and colonising, local and domestic power structures during the 200 years from 1700 to 1900. Crucially, it argues that, contrary to previous historiographies, women did shape, critique, or challenge architecture during this period, also through writing. So, Anna and Sol, you begin your explanation of the book by telling a story that draws the reader into this expanded world of architecture very effectively. Perhaps we could start there, with the story and its relationships to how you organise this complex collection of voices into a convincing whole.
Yes, the story that we're starting with, you're referring to this little anecdote where Barbara Penner, a former colleague, goes to see an exhibition at the Barbican in London and sees a textile by an artist called Mercedes Azpilicueta that's entitled Lady's Dream, or Stop Right There, Gentlemen. It's a large-scale artwork that shows a collection of images partly drawn from the period that we are writing about and retelling histories of Argentina. And it was really inspiring to hear her think about us in this context, but it also really resonated with the metaphor in which we started structuring the book. And we used this metaphor of textile production weaving to structure the book and to think about how the parts operate and become together as this whole. Weaving has been inspiring for us as a metaphor, because it is, as a textile art, was always a little bit of a belittled art, and has only recently become more recognized as a serious art that is often feminine connotated. Texts, you know, texts and weaving, writing and weaving, there's a lot of analogies in there, you know. So we structure the whole book as three parts that are weaving for longer form essays, produce histories of women writing architecture, but that also talk a lot about the methods we need to develop, for which we need to find new types of reading in order to be able to write about architecture. And then we have a center part, threads, the parts of which we really weave our fabric. And then the last part is called fabrics, which is again for longer form research essays that really demonstrate the wealth and the richness of the histories we can produce if we read, look, understand, think differently.
Well, the whole idea of weaving and threads and fabrics is also a way of making this content accessible to more people and engaging. So thank you for pointing that out in your question. And I think that for us is how to bring together the method, the product, and also the parts that come together when we write these histories. And I think that for us has been specifically enriching to do the threads as a way of bringing global histories into a conversation where you see more European stories in the weaving or the fabric section, and the threads is really where sources from around the world come together. The challenge with the threads is that maybe these are sources that are different, they're not traditionally considered in the canon. So by introducing a new way of writing about them through these micro histories, through shorter texts, it gives really an opportunity for authors from all around the world to experiment and to really try out the sources that they think that they will be useful to write about women writing architecture. And I think that that has been a really enriching process because we've seen how authors were thinking, well, maybe this could work. And with the threads, we can show that all around the world this was the case. Initially, we had the threads at the end of the book, but in the conversation with the design team, Gaguero Works, and the designer, Constanza Gaguero, she was the one who suggested why not to bring these elements, which were so different in terms of its format and its length, to the center of the book. I kind of think about this book as a tartan, you know, like these different types of threads that they have different meaning, different colors. We have these heavier sections at the beginning, at the end, with longer essays, but then in the center, we have a vast array of authors from different disciplines, from literature, as well as architectural history, coming with different perspectives of the world.
My questions mostly come from a lens of a South Asian woman, but also I will start with a general question. So, in most of the accounts in the collection, there is emphasis on going beyond conventional architectural canon to talk about women and their agency to space. How challenging was it to find these stories of women claiming agency to a space in a century when access itself was mostly restricted?
Thank you, Jabali. That's a really great question. It's also a question that we've been getting a lot. Interestingly, it was really easy to find them, and that does not meant to undermine our scholarly rigor. It's not the numbers that are the problem. So there's a lot of women writing and publishing, especially in Europe, North America, increasingly also on the other continents. Writing is a practice that is also limiting in terms of who we find, cross colonial divides and different forms of writing as well. You know, is it alphabetical writing or what else we're talking about? But generally speaking, it's not so much about finding the woman, but it's about finding the tools and methods and ways of reading them in a way that is productive in the sense of reading them as sources for architectural histories and embedding them in a sort of canonical framework while also disregarding that, exactly that canonical framework, a specific site, a specific practice, a specific spatial configuration or something. Our reading workshops, which you know part of the books come from workshops that we did, where we invited scholars to read with us primary sources in a very in-depth timed reading set that we called Reading With. And that's, I think, been really crucial for having a shared approach to how we read and what for we read and what we have to unlearn or shed in order to be able to understand different form of architectural agency, maybe of forms.
Unlearning is particularly important as well, because it is if we consider the sources of architectural history, the always the same ones that we have maybe access to in our education, then of course it will be more challenging to find women. But it requires stepping outside of those learnings and then considering the canon as a as something that established, as a framework that we need to know and work with it, of course, but then also being more creative about what are the sources that we're really considering for architectural history. But I think that what is more interesting for us is that once you take that out of your head and you start looking elsewhere, like, I don't know, in the case of my research in conventual writing or popular poetry or curriculum for schools, then women have always been there. And even in remote areas, it's also about thinking about which cultures have been developing with writing at their center. And I think that that's something that has clearly become so evident through the work in our project that in Europe, writing was central to their culture, but then you have other cultures that were highly developed that didn't have writing at all, like the Andean cultures. The sources that we need to write those histories, those sources are not in writing.
I mean, that leads me to my second question, which I think both of you now have already touched upon aspects of, which is about the way that the different texts are written in the book. It's really interesting. They are definitely introducing women's voices into a scholarly framework. And I think a lot of them are written in an instructive way, you know. So I learned so much from reading the book about different histories, about different ways of, that you can bring these histories into an architectural discourse. You know, responding as well to what Sol was saying about different kinds of writing and learning. What relationship does the book have to the extensive teaching that you've done during the course of your view research project?
So I think first maybe in terms of the texts in the book being written in an instructive way,
Instructive and explaining as well. I think
explaining,
that's,
I think that's a really interesting reflection. And I think it's due, that particularly is due to this being produced out of a 5-year research project in which we've spent a lot of time thinking about those frameworks. And actually, no, I say 5-year research project, it's a 5-year funding period, but certainly before, no, 3 years running up to this, writing grant proposals. And so it comes out of a lot of thinking and framing, and also giving authors distinct instructions or questions to answer, which is exactly that question: how can we think about writing by women in the period across this diverse and fragmented geography as constituting architecture in some way or another, as you know, and as being relevant at the center of architecture history, not marginal, not to be put into a feminine, domestic, marginal context, but really being instrumental and crucial. That's where this comes from, in all the diversity and variety that we have in here. The teaching we have done during the last 5 years during this project has been always linked to the research project, but sort of going beyond it. So I've run courses that talk about diversity and parity in architectural history. So the, you know, our own unlearning has helped us to think again about how to learn and how to read with fresh eyes.
We're all kind of experimenting and playing, but at the same time, we're all doing it around the same kind of rules. And I think that that has been super helpful. And in terms of unlearning and reading, I think that it has been really enriching as well to run all these workshops throughout the project. So Anne has been in charge of her own teaching with the students here. We have also been teaching and learning, so a pedagogy setting within these workshops that we developed together. And starting with this a listening with that we call a method that I developed first in my PhD, and then we developed together into this fantastic collective feminist method that has been really used all around the world now. We also developed it as a workshop that we were learning with scholars from different generations. And that in itself is fascinating. A fraction of a text. And then we go by layers, paying attention to things that usually maybe we just skim over. Just giving people, again, a playing field, some rules, has been incredibly productive for people throughout different kind of career stages. So, and I think that those workshops in itself, they are pedagogical opportunities and instruments where we have learned a lot from each other.
I'm glad you brought up the workshops, the reading with workshops, because I think that they really nicely also connect to the structuring and the weaving and the textile analogy that you have.
You mentioned marginality in your answer just now. My question now goes slightly beyond that point. When I was reading the second story in the book, The Case of Marianne of Orange-Nassau, I was thinking that her privilege was very much a part of her owning the property that she owned and have accessing some level of control over it. In your experience during the collation of this anthology, were there many stories of women who were further marginalized? How do you think those were recorded? And were they, would you say that they were more obscure due to intersectional marginality?
I thank you for your question. I think that this is something that has been very clear throughout the project. So again, going back to who creates the sources of writing, of course it has to do with power. Of course it has to do with money. Even in a situation where we have very little sources about women writing architecture, the first ones that will appear will be those with more power, either economic or political power. So that's why when you jump into the sources, these are the sources that you will encounter first. And in terms of intersectional marginality, then we encounter the difficulty also of women who don't know how to read and write. So then what is the source to find them? What is the source to find their agency? I'm just going to mention my paper because I guess that for me it was fascinating to find this popular poetry written by a Chilean woman. So a working class woman, a mother with a child in the center of the city of Santiago during the end of the 1800s, they used poetry as a way to earn her living. Well, you know, she was extremely famous at the time. She's already exceptional because she was able to read and write. So within the women around her, she must have been one of the very, very few that had that opportunity. So we do have to keep in mind that during this period, women who were marginalized, women of color, working class women, many of them had no possibility of reading and writing, and that was always a privilege.
I find it really interesting that you pick up on Marianne of Orange-Nassau in the chapter written by Laura Hindelang. It's been throughout a concern to have a mix of women writing that come from different classes, different backgrounds, in an intersectional way. And I think there's quite a few in the book that that express that. And also what Sole said, to go beyond or to try and find women who wrote, who might not have come from an awful lot of privilege. So, I mean, we do have, for example, Yannick Etundi's chapter on Anne Pépin, which is the only contribution to the African continent. And so he writes about Anne Pépin, a Gorean matron, and he writes about her probate will. So this is also, this is a writing of a certain kind. So writing can also be said, regarded in an extended sense, but it might also be looked at in different ways. So written testimonies or written evidence. We have Anna Ozaki, who writes about wet nurses in Brazilian big houses. So that's a very good example of that kind of expanded writing as well. My own contribution is on Marianne Ehrmann, who was a German journalist, writer, who started out from quite humble beginnings, or certainly came into humble beginnings. And she was a traveling actress at some point. She certainly came not from or was not in a privileged position when she started writing. And actually, for quite a lot of the women in this book or in our wider work, writing was a way to earn a living. And I think that's also something that needs to be acknowledged. This is so we have in our wider in the exhibition, we have a housemaid who started writing a cookbook.
And just to add to what Annie was saying is how also transient and contextual and situated marginalization is, because at the same time we have people here from Latin America that if we judge them in a global comparison, of course they would be marginalized, but within their context they would have been less or more marginalized, and that is also something that changes. And I think that that has been super interesting as well in the history, the biographies of all these women. Clorinda Mato de Turner was very famous at some point but became marginalized because of the her radical writings, so I think that also that it's nice to understand that this marginalization can also shift throughout time, and it depends really on context.
Well, that's absolutely your project, this issue of questioning what marginalization is and changing the boundaries of it.
As a South Asian woman myself, through my reading of the book, I was wondering how this records of women from the quote unquote global north or the dominant colonial powers contrast from those of the women from South Asia or Africa or other colonized peoples.
It's a challenge, and it's a challenge that we were very keen on taking on. And I think that that's also why the threads were so important for us to start kind of giving more opportunities to different sources, different perspectives. But we were confronted with the difficulty of finding those sources and finding the authors that were also willing to experiment with this. But it's important to say that here we're limited in two ways that I think that make this difference between the global north and the global south more stark. One is language. So we're asking authors to write in English. We're writing in English. It's an English publication, and of course that language makes a limitation for authors worldwide to engage in the kind of experimental or different formats that we're proposing, even though we're inviting them to write about the sources. And then on the other hand is the difficulty of finding these sources, these writings, because as it was shown by the work of Mariam Issoufou, archives of the global south have moved to the global north through colonization. So even though if the sources exist, for authors in the Global South, it's very hard to access those archives. So she's starting this great initiative of making those archives accessible through online, through digital media. But we also have to become aware that if, for example, if you're a person living in Chile, and then, for example, you need to access the archives in Spain because through colonization, the paperwork is there, that requires funding, that requires money. And then that makes it harder and harder for people in the Global South to also write their own histories.
One important thing maybe to mention in that in this context as well is that without at all glossing over these difficulties, the book benefits enormously, especially when analyzing voices of the global north, by also including voices of the colonized, or at least attempting it, and very much having the awareness of limitations of our academic system. Western academia, in all its emphasis and striving, and we are certainly part of that, striving to make it more diverse, to get as many voices heard as possible, both in terms of historical work, but also in terms of scholars doing that work and being heard. There are limitations in that system, and so that system is nowhere near perfect. Elena Rieger, a doctoral student in this project, has written about Friederike Riedesee, a German wife of a mercenary officer in the British army in the colonial war in the United States, or the Independence War. Her chapter is one of those that has really benefited from being in a context where voices of formerly enslaved individuals being heard.
But what is more interesting for me as well is that there's still sources, and I think that there's still material there. So we have the work of Mabel Wilson talking about Phyllis Wheatley, that was a formerly enslaved woman. There's so much work to do. And this book, in a way, what we were discussing from the very beginning is to just show how to do it. It's a starting point. So it's like, it's an invitation, it's a call for action for people to take on this weaving methods, to look for their own threads, and then to do their own fabrics, following with the metaphor of the book. So it's an invitation.